currently listening to Principles of Geometry and the tune Ram, the Ski Mask remix. Before this, we heard Patch with the tune Bolé. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. If you want to get in touch with me or if you missed the show, feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at several key failures of the Democratic Party amid unfolding demonstrations across the United States.
Our guest, Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, details how to build a party and government controlled by the people. We're also joined by Professor Gary Mangiovi from St. John's University in New York.
The university's embroiled in a controversy about a partnership with U.S. Customs and Border Protection establishing the Institute for Border Security and Intelligence Studies.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. The unfolding events in Los Angeles after Donald Trump called up the National Guard in violation of federal law and his threat to invoke the Insurrection Act are but his latest assaults on democracy and the Constitution. Lawyers, social justice organizations, and watchdog groups are fighting back in over 245 lawsuits against the Trump administration, winning over 180 injunctions. Last Saturday, thousands of No Kings rallies were held in every state of the Union. But many are asking, where is the Democratic Party in all this? Opinion surveys show the public is not impressed with Democratic leadership right now. What are Democrats in Congress and in state governments doing to oppose Trump and offer the American people an alternative? And what more should they be doing? To discuss these critical issues, we're joined today by Alan Minsky, the Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, PDA. Previously, Alan was a longtime program director at KPFK Radio, Los Angeles, and the coordinator of the Pacifica Radio's national political coverage. That's where I first met Alan many years ago. Progressive Democrats of America was formed in 2004 to transform the Democratic Party. PDA seeks to build a party and government controlled by citizens, not moneyed interests, with policies that serve the public and the planet. PDA is proud to say that they transformed American politics by successfully drafting Bernie Sanders to run for president as a Democrat in 2016. Alan Minsky, thank you so much for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, and I'm really happy to be here. I've been a fan of this show for decades.
Wonderful. Alan, do you think there is a crisis within the Democratic Party signified by election losses and low opinion polls? And if so, why is there such a crisis?
Oh, yes, it's dramatic. I see American politics after 2016 as having three large political factions, as it were, or movements or forces vying for control since 2016. And I would have described them, at least before the 2024 result, as on the right wing, the Trumpian hyper-reactionaries and proto-fascists, as it were, the MAGA movement. In the middle, you have the neoliberal center, which runs from the Romney wing of the Republican Party through the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. And on the left, you have the progressives. And I actually think if there was sort of a debate about the kind of vision that people had going forward between the three groups, the center would do terribly. I mean, their basically argument is to the general public, keep things the same. And we have 40, 45 years of Reagan and Thatcherite reorganization, after the post-World War II Keynesian order. That was incorporated into the left of center parties by Blair and Clinton, respectively, in England and in the United States. And we have 40, 45 years of evidence as to what that delivers. And, I mean, just taking in a sort of mass sociological broad stroke view of it, basically everybody in the society scrambles, works harder and harder and harder, even with a flow of cheap commodities produced from around the world, to keep their heads above water. And there's very little social mobility upwards. And all the wealth generated by all the people in society goes to the investor class. That is not a popular vision going forward to maintain that for the American people. And I think at 2016, you saw the dam break on what it was essentially, people thought that there was a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy for decades in the United States. In the rearview mirror, now it looks like there was pretty much a bipartisan consensus on economics. And that broke with the 2016 election. I think Barack Obama's presidency and the singularity of his presidency, first black president, great historical moment, sort of kept American politics, not really electoral politics, responding to the huge crisis of the 2007-2009 market collapse and the Great Recession that followed. And so it was the 2016 election where the dam broke, and you had Bernie Sanders on the left and Donald Trump on the right pulling apart what was a neoliberal consensus. Inside the Democratic Party, in contrast to the Republican Party, the neoliberal center still holds the reins of the party. I think this is against the wishes of the base of the party, but the money power within the Democratic Party holds the Democratic Party as essentially what is a conservative political force. It wants to conserve the status quo ante. Of course, now is all the more important for progressives somehow to maintain an alliance with those conservatives because they are constitutionalists. And so it's a very tricky moment for progressives to navigate. There's a battle within the Democratic Party between the progressive wing and the centrist wing. And the centrist wing represents politics. I fear that if it maintains the upper hand in the Democratic Party, it is pretty much a formula for a fascist America, because if the Democratic Party remains committed to the neoliberal center, as it were, and remains committed to a status quo that is unsatisfactory for the general population, and it suffocates the progressives, then you have a situation in which there's no inspiration inside the Democratic Party, as if it's led by its neoliberal moderate faction. The public feels that they're not representing their interests, and all idea of social change in the electoral realm is ceded to the fascists. So, yes, the Democratic Party is in crisis, and it will remain in crisis as long as the neoliberal center remains the dominant faction inside the party.
Alan, what is your analysis of Trumpism, and how serious a threat is it to our constitutional republic?
Well, I would argue it's very, very serious, and it's very deeply within the structures of the evolution of American society as it has occurred up until the present. Why? Because when you have massive wealth inequality in a society, we called it a plutocracy until a while ago, and now oligarchy has replaced it. You can't have an oligarchic organization of society and have a democracy. That's just like oil and water. They're just not going to blend. And neoliberalism has left us with that kind of oligarchic distribution of power and wealth in American society, especially when the money power is allowed to have such influence inside elections. So it's a corrupted democracy by the money power, and it's a corrupted society in terms of, you know, American egalitarianism, you know, obviously reaches in terms of structural distribution of wealth its high watermark coming out of the Great Depression with FDR, and that, you know, carries forward through the early 1970s. However, if you look back on American society, and of course it's difficult, of course, on a platform like this to think about how American society was experienced by the people who were allowed to be empowered within its faux democracy at the time. So in other words, not indigenous people, not black people, but white Americans. You know, the Jacksonian social contract was a vision of egalitarian society. So it was the Jeffersonian social contract that was presented. And even to a degree out of, you know, the more federalist, more sort of pro-capitalist leaning view of the world coming out of, you know, Alexander Hamilton, and to a degree the Northeast. And you go back even further. Actually, the Puritans were very, very, you know, about, there wasn't a lot of wealthy people inside Puritanism. It was a very sort of class flattened structure. So America has always had within it this idea that this is a country for all the people, where prosperity is available for all the people. It's deeply ingrained in the American story. And that's just broken now. Everybody knows it's broken. If you're a middle class household, even a two income middle class household, you're just going to get broken by childcare costs, cost of housing, the cost of college, and then finally health bills, especially at the end of your life, unless you're unlucky in an earlier part of your life. And so there's no socially, no way forward except for a tiny, tiny, tiny portion of the population who break through this. Most people basically are just treading water, working harder and harder, and slowly going underwater. And this is why there's an appetite for Sanders' politics, which is huge. He's the most popular politician in the country again. And why there's an appetite for Trump, because Trump promises to break the mold. And so it's very serious Trumpism, because it is what this kind of oligarchic structure it begat, which is a desire of the very wealthy. And this is sort of driven by, you know, BS philosophers like Curtis Yarvin, who's just constructed a rationalization for giving all social power to his mentor Peter Thiel, and the Silicon Valley oligarchs who've always embraced this kind of Ayn Randian ideology to consolidate the power, the political power, that matches their economic power in American society and suffocate democracy. It's real and it's happening. Just, I don't know what to make about Trump, his personality, what to call him. I'm not going to get the right insult thrown out spontaneously at this moment. He's obviously a complex psychological character, but he's a hyper-narcissist, and he seems in his narcissism at this moment to want to be a kind of tin pot dictator, and he's going for it. And it matches up with a society that has this kind of imbalance in economic and political power.
So in the face of that, how and will and should the Democratic Party change in order to confront and defeat Trumpism?
It's a great question. Here's the thing I'm going to say. It's mildly controversial in some circles. I also think it's absolutely non-controversial if people just take a broad stroke view of American society. Look, for some reason within our political system, to an extreme extent, we have a two-party system. I believe it's because of these two large national parties that operate in elections run by 50 states. The elections are operated by the states. And so if a third party has gained any momentum in any state, the national parties have the resources to come in and crush that. I don't think there's any appetite at all for third partyism to really take hold now, even though both parties are phenomenally unpopular with the public, because, well, obviously the Republican MAGA base are happy with where that is. And then on the Democratic side, you just aren't going to have a third party formation emerge when the alternative is fascism. Right, that lesson has been learned. So there's one national institution that has the breadth and capacity to defeat Trumpism, and it's the Democratic Party. It has to get its act together. So what should be done? What needs to happen? And it has to be done in a way, of course, in terms of organizational management, in a way that's not too unruly. But the The easy way forward is pretty clear. You invite the general public into the party. Okay? All of these people who are out there demonstrating right now, and as they should, and I have, by the way, when I hear Mayor Bass, I mean, it might be the way the media is cutting up her message, but I think more than Newsom and more than Rob Bont out here in California, Karen Bass has been scolding the demonstrators. Well, these demonstrators initially, you know, started out on a Friday when there were raids and at a Home Depot and at a place where people worked, and those in Paramount and in Compton. And they were responding to an emergency in a way that they did. And then people, of course, are as good citizens going to where the National Guard is deployed and saying, no, this is wrong. This is not the country we live in. And I don't think the people in any way should be scolded. However, if you look at those groups of people, and all the people are even out at the No Kings demonstrations, and we're talking about, you know, millions of people, the idea that they should become Democratic Party activists, it's like, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. That's nothing that's ever even crossed their mind to consider. That right there is the constitutive core of the failure of the Democratic Party, which is that it is an insular institution currently. The Clinton and Obama years produced in state after state after state a group of people who see themselves as the people who are doing the work inside the party. They belong where they are. And of course, the whole structure is held in place by the relationship of the party to what's called the consultants and the consultancy class. And, you know, even DNC Chair Ken Martin, who is sort of breaking the mold enough to hope there's a glimmer of hope there with him. But, you know, he denies the influence of the consultancy class and says they've been let go. That is nonsense. The Democratic Party runs primarily as a fundraising machine so that a network of people can continue to get their paychecks. That has to end. We need to welcome the general public into the party. We have to ask everybody who opposes Trump, everybody who opposes American fascism, to in some way, and of course people work many, many hours, and they have families to raise, and they don't have time to do it. Again, organizational management acumen, we need to find a way to engage all these people to get them to understand that the Democratic Party is theirs. And it has to end all this nonsense. I mean, I'm not the hugest fan of Chris Murphy. He's definitely a politician I feel has somewhat more promise than, say, the more establishment old guard. But he does say, stop castigating the progressives. And the reality is after Sanders in 2016, there was an effort at mass entryism into the party from the base of Sanders supporters, and they were rebuffed. Whatever wall needed to be built to keep them out, it was built, state after state after state. They actually broke through in about 5 to 8 states. But, you know, even therein, you have situations where we do have a more open and embracing Democratic Party in Washington state with a great statewide chair. But that doesn't dislodge the fact that you have 2 neoliberal senators from a very, very, very progressive state. And that's because of the role of the consultancy money. It's impossible to challenge a sitting Democratic senator, let's be honest. And the money that's required, that has to be broken.
Alan, what are a few domestic policies that Progressive Democrats of America promotes that you feel the Democratic Party should embrace?
I am the co-author of 2 sweeping proposals along those lines and hope to be on a few others. The main top umbrella proposal is a 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights. I've authored a bunch of articles with the Rooseveltian scholar and author of books about Tom Paine, too. Professor Harvey J.K. So we've written a series of about 5 articles advocating for a 21st century economic bill of rights. Data for Progress did polling around it, and it absolutely is phenomenally more popular than anything that like a recent Democratic Party platform. It actually has on all of the 10 bullet points. Actually, I think they only polled on 8 of them because at that point it had 8. We expanded it to 10. And we have a proposal into Congress to have it be adopted. It's actually folded into a piece of legislation that was introduced by Barbara Lee and Pramila Jayapal last Congress. But we want it as a standalone bill, and we're sort of negotiating who might introduce it. When Bernie Sanders spoke in Los Angeles to his largest crowd yet on his Fighting Oligarchy tour, about 2/3 of the way through, he pivoted to speak about Franklin Roosevelt's 2nd Bill of Rights speech that he gave in 1944, which, of course, is the inspiration for our proposal. You know, that calls for, you know, universal living wage. The idea that if anybody works a job, whether it's the private sector or the public sector, having one job where you work 40 hours a week, that you make a living wage, okay? And that there's universal health care, there's housing as a human right, on down the line, adjusted for the 21st century. And so, you know, we want, free education all the way through, graduate school. We want free child care and, you know, universal broadband, all the things you need that some of them didn't exist, of course, in Roosevelt's time. So it's adjusted for the 21st century, and that's easily found. Now, of the other proposals that we put forward, one that is gaining a lot of traction that I also co-authored was a Rural New Deal proposal, and we co-authored it with the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative, co-authors Anthony Flaccavento, and can look up his work. It's incredible. Nation Magazine has picked it up and is championing it, and we're just looking for the right person to introduce it. And this is just very simple. The Democratic Party has abandoned rural and small-town America. If it's sort of viewed as a state, rural and small-town America is like a one-party state. It's run by the Republican Party. And by the way, rural and small-town America, their attitudes across rural and small-town America, do you think the society is going in the right direction? I think you know what the polls say about that in rural and small-town America. The answer is an unequivocal no. So there's no satisfaction with the political leadership across those parts of the country. But the Democratic Party has entirely abandoned the mainstream of the Democratic Party trying to win in rural and small-town America. Okay, so you put forward a set of progressive policy proposals, and guess what? They're popular across rural and small-town America. Now, there's other barriers to the Democratic Party, you know, picking up and winning. Yeah, across rural and small town America. But to not even try when progressives have the best policies for the communities there, certainly in my opinion, and I think you look at the proposals of the Rural New Deal, and you'll see, yeah, people are going to like this across this part of the country. So we're trying to build off of that as well.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, co-host with Heidi Boghossian. And today we're listening and talking to Alan Minsky, the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. You've outlined initiatives on the domestic side. What should a progressive foreign policy look like that will capture leadership in the United States and support of the American people? Foreign policy toward Israel, Iran, the Ukraine, and elsewhere.
Well, first and foremost, of course, I think the United States needs to be leading with diplomacy and calling for peace in all regions and doing whatever it can to leverage its power. And in a second, I want to talk about how Trump is changing things and how it can be rebuilt after this. And the Democratic Party needs to do that both domestically and internationally in the wake of the bull in the China shop effect that Trump is having on innumerable planes, both domestically and internationally. But right off the bat, I mean, we need to reaffirm our support for international law. And, you know, by the way, I've been looking for, and I have these relationships now with a bunch of progressive Congress people. And, you know, I'd certainly herald and applaud Delia Ramirez's Block the Bombs Act that she just introduced last week pertaining to offensive weapons no longer being allowed to be sent to Israel. But, you know, if you go up on Congress and you say, let's put in a resolution calling for the United States to reaffirm its support for international law, everybody will view that as, okay, if you introduce this bill, AIPAC, United Democracy Fund, what Mearsheimer and Walt had called the Israel lobby, will go after, you know, hardcore whoever introduces that bill. So, yes, of course, it speaks to that particular issue, but it's something we need to do across the board. And so a United States that honestly, I mean, there's always been, you know, the United States supports human rights, but honestly supporting what is understood by international law to be unequivocal support for human rights, the right of self-determination of peoples, and international law. So that right off the bat is very easy, and I think at this hour it needs to be central to a progressive approach to foreign policy. Look, the money in primaries from, in particular, not exclusively, again, what Mearsheimer and Walt called the Israel lobby, which is now much, much more fierce in this approach than it even was previously, because it feels challenged, was prohibited, defeated, of course, Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman, but a number of very, very good progressive congressional candidates who lost in deep blue districts, one of them lost by 39 votes, to candidates that were overwhelmingly funded and would not have even been competitive without the funding from a combination of AIPAC, United Democracy Fund, Democratic Majority for Israel, as well as crypto money. this is something that progressives have to be highly cognizant of going into the 2026 election. The state of Arizona, in a PDA-led initiative, by the way, has the first state in the country, the Democratic Party, to call for the outlawing of that kind of dark money in Democratic Party primaries. So that has to happen. Going back to foreign policy, look, there's a bunch of stuff that the United States standing in the world is obviously teetering in a way. I mean, much like I never thought I'd see Marines in the city I live in occupying the city. It's sad. Occupied Los Angeles was a positive term only, 12 years ago or whatever it was during the Occupy Wall Street era. More than that now, 14 years ago. Now it's something much more harrowing. But on the international stage, we also, by the way, are working on a fair trade and fair tariffs piece of legislation because, not all tariffs are bad. And we have a problem with the moderate wing of the Democratic Party reverting to free trade. I mean, talk about a way that the moderate wing of the Democratic Party can take what should be an absolute slam dunk win over the chaos that Trump has created for everybody, and the inflation now is going up because of his absurd approach to tariffs, well, in the China shop approach to it, and his ridiculous understanding of the role of tariffs in the 21st century. But that doesn't mean all tariffs are bad. And we need to put forward a sound piece of legislation for the level at which and the spaces in which tariffs are appropriate. And so we're working with Public Citizen Global Trade Watch, with Lori Wallach, actually some other people whose names I can't mention have a very high profile on this because it's just being developed. But again, it's a PDA-led initiative. I know when people think of foreign policy, they tend to think of hot wars and things like that. But obviously, trade is a huge part of it, as is, of course, absolutely foregrounding and making center the climate emergency. But I do believe that we have to understand that, and we have to demand an even stricter regimen. And therein, again, this is a huge and massive jobs program, as the Green New Deal understood a transition over to green energy. And that's no less true today than it was when the Green New Deal was introduced by AOC in 2019.
Alan, we're out of time, which is regrettable because it's been a very informative interview. How can listeners learn more about PDA, follow your work, and get involved?
Social media handles, but more directly even go to pdamerica.org. That's pdamerica.org. And click on join and join us. There's no membership dues necessary. And again, we're trying, and we're one of the organizations really leading the way to try to transform the Democratic Party into the party the country needs. And that includes, all variations of progressive and radical approaches and thoughts are welcome in the Democratic Party that I envision and I believe the country needs. None of this nonsense neo-McCarthyism of shutting down radical ideas or trying to keep everything into some kind of constrained liberal tradition. We need a Democratic Party that is really a party of the people of the United States. And I know people can't imagine participating. It's incumbent upon us to make participation agreeable. So finding ways to keep people engaged that don't take too much of their time. But if you have a lot of time and you want to help try to save our constitutional democratic republic, it's going to require a transformed Democratic Party. And we want to have everybody listening right now join us in trying to make this into what it needs to be, the Democratic Party, and to return the United States back to a path of being a constitutional democracy. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with both of you.
Alan, thank you. Thank you for what you do every day, and thank you for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Controversy is brewing at St. John's University in Queens, New York, an institution known for its Catholic and Vincentian mission to serve the poor, the immigrant, and the marginalized. A recently announced partnership between the university and U.S. Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, has sparked backlash among faculty, students, alumni, and human rights advocates. In dispute is a new Institute for Border Security and Intelligence Studies, a training center for Homeland Security professionals created in collaboration with CBP's New York field office. Since the announcement, more than 900 members of the St. John's community have signed a petition calling for immediate termination of the partnership. They contend that working with an agency accused of human rights violations, notably against immigrants and communities of color, stands in opposition to university values. They also cite concerns about academic freedom and the safety of immigrant students and faculty. But just like any controversy, there are two sides. Supporters of the partnership cite the benefits of real-world training and federal job opportunities. However, our guest today will tell us about potential downsides. Joining us to discuss what it means for a Catholic university to host a Border Patrol training center is St. John's economics professor Gary Mongiovi. His main area of specialization is the history of economic ideas, particularly those of John Maynard Keynes and Karl Marx, and non-mainstream approaches in economics. Recently, he's been working on the ideological role that economics plays in society. Gary has been a member of the editorial board of the Review of Radical Political Economics since 1994. His writings have appeared in the Cambridge Journal of Economics, Catalyst, Critical Sociology, Social Research, Metro Economica, and The Nation. Gary, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
Can you briefly explain the nature of the partnership between St. John's University and U.S. Customs and Border Protection?
Sure. In early May, St. John's University announced the establishment of a partnership with the New York Field Office of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which, as you know, is an arm of the Department of Homeland Security. And what we call a memorandum of understanding was signed at the end of April. This was announced then just a few days later. The university has a College of Professional Studies, and that college has a degree program in Homeland Security. So this partnership is intended to support that degree program. There will be an Institute for Border Security and Intelligence Studies being established. No, we don't know much more than that, since the university administration has not, as far as I know, released the text of the memorandum of understanding, even though they've been asked to do so by members of the university community. So that's pretty much what we know about the nature of the program. Now, it's usual for these sorts of agreements to have arrangements for student internships, for speakers from, say, in this case, the Border Protection Agency coming to campus and talking to students. Possibly you would draw on the agency for adjunct faculty. And then, of course, there are recruitment channels for students who are looking for jobs. I should add that there's no information on the funding of the new institute, even though that institute will require the deployment of resources. And this is going on while the university is implementing austerity across the campus. There's a hiring freeze on, for example.
What was your initial reaction when you learned about the establishment of this new Institute for Border Security and Intelligence Studies?
Well, initially, my reaction was disappointment and sadness. I think those were the immediate reactions that I had. I've been working at St. John's for over 40 years now, and I've always been proud to work for St. John's. And that is because, in large part, because of the university's commitment to Vincentian values and social justice. St. John's was founded in the late 1880s to provide an opportunity for the children of immigrants and working families, working class people, to get a college degree. So this partnership with Border Protection seems like a betrayal of those values. One colleague used the term heartbroken to describe her feelings when I was talking to her a few weeks ago, and that is appropriate. I feel some of that too.
I'm curious, Gary, can you talk just briefly about how those values play out generally in the curriculum, in campus life?
The faculty is highly mindful of that. What is distinctive about St. John's University is that we provide an education that is highly focused on Vincentian values and social justice. There's a Vincentian Center for Social Justice. A lot of the faculty are doing research in income inequality and the conditions that perpetuate inequality and economic injustice. So it's in the ethos. It's all of our students, including in the business school where I teach, are required to take courses in ethics. I think there is a lot of focus on those issues in the kinds of guest speakers that we have, again, including in the business school. We try and get speakers very often who are giving talks on issues connected to ethical business practices.
What do you see as some of the legal and ethical risks in hosting CPB agents and programs on a college campus?
Well, you know, Customs and Border Protection is an ethically problematic branch of the federal government. So a Human Rights Watch report from 2021 indicates that Border Protection agencies' agents have abused refugees and asylum seekers, both physically and sexually. Refugees and asylum seekers have been denied access to medication and necessary health care. They've been denied access to adequate nutrition and shelter. Personal property has been stolen from them by individual agents. And then, of course, we're all aware of the fact that the agency separated thousands of children from their parents. There's no evidence that the agency has been reformed, nor is there any evidence that the defects have even seriously been investigated by the federal government or Congress. You know, it's pretty staggering to anyone's sense of basic human decency that a Catholic university would enter into a formal partnership with an agency that has a record like this. You know, Jesus of Nazareth said that we should welcome the stranger and help him when he needs it. Border Protection now functions not merely to keep the needy out of the U.S., but to treat them badly enough that other refugees will hesitate to ask for asylum. I am personally deeply troubled that by partnering with Border Protection, the university is giving a Catholic and a Vincentian seal of approval to an agency that is permeated by corruption and ethical problems.
Indeed. Gary, how have immigrant and non-citizen members of the St. John's community responded to the announcement? I know the petition had more than 900 signatures, but are people afraid of how it might impact them individually?
Well, no one in the university community that I've spoken to outside of the administration favors this. And I don't personally have a breakdown of, you know, who's an immigrant, who has a green card and so forth. The people that I do know who are here on teaching on green cards, they're concerned. They're worried. They are not happy about this. I might add that we have heard nothing from the university's administration about protocols for what to do if ICE shows up in our classroom, or what plans the university has to protect students and employees who might be targeted. You know, so people were already worried. We haven't had any indication from the administration that there's, you know, a plan for dealing with possible threats to people in our community who might be targeted. And instead, what we've got is an announcement of a university partnership with Customs and Border Protection. That's bound to amplify people's anxiety.
Well, if I may, in a Catholic setting be a devil's advocate. What does the university claim? What are their arguments in favor of this? Do they believe it will enhance educational and career opportunities? Are those justifiable goals?
Well, certainly this is their claim, that this program will enhance career opportunities, educational opportunities for students in that Homeland Security program. And it will, of course, but that doesn't justify the partnership. What would justify the partnership would be if the partnership was with an entity that was not ethically compromised. I think that is the problem. Yes, of course, we want students to have opportunities. We want them to learn how to act professionally, how to conduct policing ethically and professionally. The problem is that we're partnering with an organization that has not behaved professionally and ethically. So those justifications ring hollow to me and to many, many other members of the university community.
Gary, it seems likely that this partnership could create a chilling effect on academic freedom, but also on student activism. And I'm curious if you can talk a bit about, has there been activism on the St. John's campus, and what has the response by the administration been?
Well, there has been some activism. There are gay, lesbian, trans groups on campus, and they are tolerated, and not just tolerated, but welcome by the administration. The administration has, in recent years, been very supportive of trans and gay students. There are political organizations, there are Islamic student organizations. They do engage in activism. It tends not to be highly disruptive, but the administration in general has, to my knowledge, been open and tolerant of it.
Gary, are you familiar with other programs and partnerships of this kind at other universities?
I know of no other university program that has a partnership with Customs and Border Protection. I do know that John Jay College has a program that provides training to police officers and trains people in policing, and it's a university degree program. And obviously, that program also has a partnership with the university, with the New York City Police Department. But that is an entirely different order of magnitude from the agreement that St. John's has with Border Protection, which is a heavily ethically compromised agency.
I'm curious about the role that transparency, or the lack thereof, played in fueling the backlash from the university community.
There would have been a backlash in any case, but the lack of transparency has exacerbated it. There has been little to no transparency. This plan has been in the works for 2 years, as I understand it, but almost no one on campus knew about it until it was released. The announcement was made in early May. As I mentioned, the university has declined to release the memorandum of understanding, and that has made people angry. This, to me and to many other people, this shows a lack not just of transparency, but of respect for faculty who have raised reasonable concerns that the program might be in conflict with our values and our mission. So people are feeling that lack of respect pretty acutely right now, and this is driving a lot of the resistance.
So how has the university itself, the administrators, how have they responded to the petition and calls for terminating the partnership, and how does their response compare to how responsive they've been on other issues historically?
Well, on controversial issues, the university administration tends to be slow to respond, and I think that's not unusual. But they've not responded to the petition, except with canned PR, public relations statements. They've argued through a public relations spokesperson. It's just like any other memorandum of understanding. But we don't really know that because the memorandum has not been released. And I would add that, as far as I know, the university does not have any other partnerships with organizations that routinely violate people's human and civil rights. So, yeah, there has been a lack of transparency. When I was part of the delegation that handed the petition to the provost, and when I handed it to him, I said, you know, we're giving you this on behalf of the university community, and we hope that you and the president will read it, take it seriously, and respond seriously to it. Now, this was several weeks ago, and I'm sure they have read it. I'm sure they are taking it seriously, but they have not responded seriously.
Now, Gary, you mentioned John Jay College of Criminal Justice here in New York City. Generally, what alternatives are you aware of that exist for educating students both in law enforcement and Homeland Security, but that don't involve aligning with federal agencies like CBP?
I'm an economist. I have a pretty acute awareness of the role that economists play in advising governments. And economists are employed throughout the federal government and throughout state and local governments in advising them on policy issues, in providing information to them policymakers need to make good policy. In general, I don't see anything problematic about academics engaging with the federal government to help solve the problems of a complex society. You would certainly want experts in public health and medicine advising the federal government, and indeed employed by the federal government and getting grants and having partnerships with the federal government to provide policy guidance that can benefit all of society. I know that economists have also worked for the CIA, and that personally is not something that I would do, but I don't think that it is unethical for economists or social scientists to work for the CIA. It all is contingent on what those branches of the government are doing. If they're trying to do useful things that benefit society at large, then there is absolutely nothing wrong with a partnership between governments and academic institutions. But when government is doing something wrong, is behaving unethically, is implementing policies that are harmful to humanity, then I think it is incumbent upon academics to challenge those policies. If they can challenge those policies while being part of a partnership, fine. Right? If the partnership becomes more important than the aim of doing something useful for society, then I think it's problematic.
Just like to add that with the crackdown we've seen from the current administration and a lot of the elite campuses across the country, I would imagine they would greatly welcome having sort of a government arm on certain campuses that might supply them not only with future staffers, but instill more of what we've seen in a lot of high schools with junior ROTC programs, a kind of observance to a military type thinking. But I'm curious, Gary, how religious leaders or theologians, either within or outside the university, have weighed in on this issue.
Yeah, those concerns about infiltrating the ethos of the institution are legitimate. I think if the university is doing its job of training people to think critically, and particularly to think critically about authority, then I think the universities are doing what they should be doing, and problems will not be so severe. In April, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops announced a decision not to renew its cooperative agreements with the federal government related to children's services and refugee support. And that is because they have objections to the way those services are being provided, and they have concerns about the ethical ramifications of government entities that are providing those services. And I would just add also that, well, we have a new pope, and he's only been in office a short time, but he certainly is on the side of immigrants and refugees and asylum seekers. Obviously, the Catholic Church, it's a big tent. There are conservatives and liberals, and they operate across a wide spectrum. But in my experience, and certainly on St. John's campus, the feeling is that we should be as open as possible to immigrants, and that what ICE and Border Protection are doing is wrong, and that we should not align ourselves with them.
Gary, do you see a selectivity on the part of the federal and the Trump administration going on as it relates to universities in a bigger picture? The Trump administration is cutting back on funding for DEI programs, transgender research, LGBTQ community services. Yet here it's funding border protection and law enforcement and programs of that kind. In my field, that's called viewpoint discrimination, and you could call it selectivity. Do you see that at work currently?
Well, I certainly do see it. As I said before, I don't know how this institute is being funded at St. John's. Again, that memorandum of understanding has not been released, so we don't know where the funding is coming from. I'm sure that various programs, research programs at St. John's have had their funding cut, because every university has experienced that. That's problematic, and universities need a plan to respond to that, which is one of the reasons why people are concerned that the St. John's University Administration has not issued a statement indicating what their plan is for dealing with this kind of thing.
Gary, we've run out of our allotted time, but quickly, what are the next steps for students, faculty, and alums who oppose the Institute, and what can our listeners do to support them?
Well, I think that the people who have organized the resistance to this initiative are prepared to keep fighting until the program is rescinded. I think the ultimate goal is to have the partnership rescinded. And we are strategizing now about what the next steps are. Partly it will be reactive to what the university administration says. We're still waiting for them to respond to our concerns. I think that they may be hoping that this will blow over. That by the time the summer is over and the new semester starts, people will have forgotten about this as an issue. I think they are mistaken. People are really angry about this. They are upset. They are disappointed. And I will use the word again, many of us are heartbroken. We feel that this is a betrayal. Our love of the university and what it stands for is going to keep us on top of this issue. What the next steps will be, that I really don't know for sure.
Well, Gary, we'll be sure to follow you and look for updates as they happen. Meanwhile, thank you so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. Good talking to you.
of us at Law and Disorder would like to give a special thanks to our listeners, both for their support and for their financial contributions. A big thank you goes out now to Allison, Rosemary, Tarek, Naomi, John, Marcus, and Kayla. We really appreciate you. Visit lawanddisorder.org to learn how you can support our team.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue our coverage of the Israeli-U.S. genocidal assault against the people of Palestine.
Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges, who joins us to update the situation in Gaza. His recent book is titled A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. We then take a look at the MAGA ideology with returning guest, Monthly Review editor John Bellamy Foster.
We'll discuss his recent Monthly Review article titled The MAGA Ideology and the Trump Regime.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The world looks on in horror as Israel continues its genocidal assault on the Palestinian people. According to Benjamin Netanyahu, and I quote, "The only inevitable outcome will be the wish of Gazans to emigrate outside of the Gaza Strip." He told this to his lawmakers at an elite closed-door meeting. And he continues, "But our main problem is finding countries to take them in." According to our guest today, Chris Hedges, the Israeli war in Gaza marks the end of a world where humanitarian law, conventions that protect civilians, really matter. In a recent piece, Hedges claims that the genocide in Gaza is part of a pattern. It is the harbinger of genocides to come, he writes. It puts to rest the lie of human progress, the myth that we are evolving morally. Only the tools change. Where once we clubbed victims to death or chopped them to pieces with broadswords, today we drop 2,000-pound bombs on refugee camps, spray families with bullets from militarized drones, or pulverize them with tank shells, heavy artillery, and missiles. So we've invited Chris Hedges to join us today to discuss the situation in Gaza and what he claims it portends for the future of relations between the peoples of this world. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, and the former Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. Among his books is A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. Well, Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you very much.
Chris, in a recent writing of yours, you claimed that Gaza's present situation was foretold long ago. You also recently interviewed Amy Kaplan, author of Our American Israel, The Story of Entangled Alliance. So talk to us about this notion, your contention, really, that Gaza's history was long ago foretold.
Well, you know, I spent 7 years in the Middle East and much of that time in Gaza covering the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the antecedents of the current genocide have long been part of Israel's essentially DNA. In 1948, a series of massacres and the displacement of roughly 750,000 Palestinians. And then in the 1967 war, another 350,000 Palestinians were displaced. But in between those conflicts and after that, there was a kind of slow motion ethnic cleansing, which I covered. With the rise of Netanyahu, his father was a member of the Herut Party. The Herut Party came out of the Zionist terrorist groups, the Irgun and others, and always called for the seizure of all of historic Palestine. I also had covered Meir Kahana, which Meir Kahana is lifted up as this radical right-wing figure, which was the heir of Vladimir Jabotinsky, who Mussolini, and I quote, called a good fascist. This kind of strain of fascism was always in the Zionist project. Life for Palestinians under liberal Zionism was not much better than under this current fascistic Zionism. The difference being that, like Trump, they're kind of more open about their intent. So what we saw on October 7th essentially green-lighted this final effort to drive the Palestinians out of Gaza. And if they get away with it, and it looks like they will turn on the West Bank. But that's always been part of the Zionist project.
Chris, what then do you believe will be the most likely outcome of the Israeli-U.S.-supported genocide assault on Gaza and elsewhere in Palestine?
Well, everything changed on March 2nd with the enforced starvation. And that, of course, means that there's very little time left. They have set up these woefully inadequate, quote-unquote, feeding stations in the south along the 9-mile border with Egypt to lure Palestinians who are hungry, of course, like mice into a trap. I think that there's a supposition among many of us, much of that area is just a fence between that and the Egyptian Sinai, and you create this mass of desperate humanity, and they just essentially burst through fence. The fact that Israel is just refusing to allow any food or humanitarian aid in other than this kind of symbolic, you know, there's what, two or three feeding stations. And of course, there have been riots, not unexpectedly, with over 20 people shot and killed. I mean, the whole thing is very cynical and no one's doing anything to stop it. I mean, the United States just vetoed a ceasefire resolution at the UN. So you've seen the rhetoric change out of Europe with Starmer and Macron and others. But of course, they're still funneling the weapons to perpetuate the genocide. So I think our fear is that we're probably weeks away. If food is not let in, there is really very little time left.
Chris, you've written in one of your reports that, and I quote, "In fact, genocide is the currency of Western
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those